This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
Hey, pod people. Welcome to another exciting episode of Through the Abyss podcast. I'm your co-host, Ben.
And I'm your co-host, Mandy.
And today we will be talking to San Francisco public defender, Martina Avalos. Hey, Martina, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for coming. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into law, how you ended up where you are?
You know, I don't quite know how I ended up in law school. I think I wasn't sure what else to do. But I, since law school, I've been focused on criminal defense and criminal defense only. Started in law school, was my first internship at a public defender's office, and that's all I've done. So I worked both as a private defense attorney, worked in public defense in 4 counties now, currently in San Francisco. I handle at this point everything from low-level felonies all the way up to homicides. I've previously supervised people, but currently I'm just kind of focusing on my own caseload. And it's a mixed caseload. So there's no kind of one unit I'm assigned to, you know, whether it's sexual assault or homicide, it's everything. So I think I've kind of touched on just about everything in my career thus far. But, you know, I haven't tried a homicide yet, so handled lots of them, but definitely never had anything like this case. San Francisco, we do get a lot of high media kind of cases, so that is fun.
When you say you've handled homicide cases, that mean they just got like plead out?
Yeah, they either resolve or get dismissed, you know, at this point.
Wow, they get dismissed?
Sometimes. Sometimes wow. People are totally innocent.
Well, that's true. That's true. Not like this case, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So you are familiar with this lovely person's case trial. History.
You know, it's weird. I don't think I paid that much attention to it when it was happening. Mm-hmm. I think I was in law school and just must have missed a lot of it, which is surprising because I think I would have been glued to it during law school, but I think I just missed a lot of it. So going back in preparation for this, you know, I was kind of fascinated by all of the different kind of issues with the trial.
When it happened, I was in college and I was glued to it every day. I mean, when the verdict came out, I had brought my laptop to, I think it was my math chemistry class. And I flat out told my professor, when it happens, we got to stop because I got to watch this. And he totally did. My whole class watched the verdict and we didn't get much done after that because we were all discussing that verdict.
Yeah, some of those verdicts, you remember exactly where you were and what you were doing. Kind of like O.J. Simpson.
God, yeah.
Well, one of the questions I had for you, it's pretty clear to me anyways, and to Mandy as well, we discussed it earlier about her defense did a lot of fabrication. They created a lot of stories. Is that something that if the judge determines that's occurring, they could do something about, or is that pretty much fair game for a defense?
So what I think you're referring to, and unfortunately I didn't hear kind of the discussion about the fabrication, right? So I won't call it fabrication, right? I'm not going to speak to what other attorneys do, but what the rules are is that for opening, which is where I think he introduced this. Now, maybe it came out of the media ahead of time, which might've been a really smart move, right? As a defense attorney, if you want to craft a defense and put it out in the public ahead of time, you may want to do that if you're okay with tipping your hand ahead of time. You may not want to if it's, you know, as you said, fabricated, because then you're going to give the prosecution a lot of time to look into it and potentially knock it down. But you can open on it. And if you open on it, then it's going to be up to you. Are you going to be able to make good on it by presenting witnesses? Are you not? Is it enough just to put it in their heads? Now, in this case, you know, they put a lot of stuff out that may have been very hard for them, even if it had been true to prove, right? Who would have been, like, for instance, a witness that could have testified to what happened about the pool. It was either the dad or Casey. And Casey chose not to testify, and the dad said that didn't happen. Or I can't remember, did the dad say that didn't happen? I know he said that the
molestation and the drowning didn't happen.
So who else could have really testified to that and said, here's what happened? Or the molestation, who might have been privy to that? You wouldn't have a lot of witnesses of molestation. So it could be very hard to prove a negative. But to answer your question specifically, that's why the judge did preclude the defense attorney from arguing it in closing. And it was because there was no evidence presented at trial. At opening, it was fair game.
Okay.
That just seems so unethical. Because, I mean, I don't believe for one second that George Anthony had anything to do with Kaylee's death. And I certainly don't believe that he molested Casey either. I think that was just something Baez came up with basically all he wants to do is just be able to slip that reasonable doubt in, right? I mean, is that, from your standpoint, is that something that you would ever do, is fabricate something to it? Because I mean, I know you want to present the best defense for your client, but it just seems really unethical to me.
So I think fabrication, I'm going to shy away from using that word, right? Okay. I think fabricating a defense is by its very definition unethical. Now, if a prosecutor was to say defense fabricated this, I would object as being misconduct if somebody said that. Can you tell a witness to lie? Absolutely not. If you know a witness is going to lie on stand, you cannot question them normally. There's all these rules involved. I was just going to say, there's rules in place to prevent people from lying. But, you know, do defense attorneys spin narratives? Do they craft narratives? Do they come up with their own? Sure. And I think in a situation like this, where if you take a step back and, you know, and look at what did the prosecution really have, right, in terms of the body, we have, and like, what do they really know? They were spinning facts themselves, right? They're facts that you think were the right spin, but that's what they were doing. They didn't have any confession. They didn't have an autopsy that really showed she'd been murdered. They didn't have anything other than some circumstantial, and I hate using circumstantial. They also had direct evidence, but you know, they kind of had the circumstantial evidence that Casey wanted a different life. And that was the narrative that they really wanted to push forward. And because of that, they're spinning the facts the same way that the defense are spinning facts. It just seems that with the pool thing, that seems very specific, right? They've come up with that in a way that you don't believe that that's true. And then they never made good on it. That, I think, crosses a line if you open on it and you know it to be something that you're not going to be able to prove. That would be something that would be unethical, technically. But if you take it one step down, right, trying to craft an alternate narrative of accident, or we don't know, saying like, look, we don't know what this shows. At the end of this, you're not going to see any information that shows conclusively that Kaylee was murdered. So it could be this, it could be that, it could be an accident. And if you as the defense attorney in good faith believe that somebody was going to testify to this pool stuff and then it just went sideways, that would be ethical. But as a defense attorney, you're very much allowed to craft alternate narratives. You really are just not allowed to put on people who you know are lying.
So do you think that's, you think that's a big reason why Casey didn't testify in this, is because he crafted that narrative, and if he put her on the stand, he knows that she would have to lie about it?
Maybe. I mean, I think there's a million reasons I wouldn't have put her on the stand, right? There's a million different things. Like, and I mean, defense attorneys all have a different ethical code. A lot of defense attorneys will feel comfortable putting someone on the stand that they've told a story of different versions, right? So as long as you don't know that your client for sure is lying, is that ethical? And everybody has a different ethical code. I would venture a guess that there were other reasons that this particular defense attorney, not that I know him or know his ethical kind of standard, but I mean, it seems a bit murky, but I think it probably had more to do with her demeanor, not seeming credible, not being very likable. You know, she wouldn't have come across sympathetic. She probably would have sunk her own ship, even if she was telling the truth, right? She just seems to be a genuinely pretty self-involved human who would not yes. have come across as really very...
like a mom who just lost her kid.
Right. Yeah. You would expect a lot more emotion. And, yeah. you know, regardless of her reasons for being so kind of removed during her jail calls and times when we got to hear what she was saying about Kaylee behind the scenes, that would not have played well. So I would have made the same decision to keep her off the stand potentially. You know, if she couldn't have gotten up and really told a very credible story about the pool. And now she got up and she told a really credible story. I mean, I probably, and every defense attorney's position on how you present your witnesses are very different, you know? So some defense attorneys think I would never put my client on, and some put them on every time. So it really is just very personal.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that because I've heard that a lot of the times defense attorneys will not want their client to testify.
I used to be of that mindset that I really do not want them to ever take the stand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's scary. And, you know, you think, who's going to be able to relate to this, especially as a public defender? You know, you're working with clients who may not have the same educational background as the jury pool. So there's a million different reasons why you may not want them to take the stand. But at the end of the day, I've really kind of shifted. I've changed because I've decided that juries really do kind of understand that. And that they're a lot less judgmental than maybe I gave them credit for previously. And that if you work with your client and how to speak publicly, then it can be a very powerful tool.
And you got to do a lot of prepping a lot of the time to get them
yeah,
ready for
it. I like that you said prepping, not coaching. But yeah, no, it's a foreign skill, you know, to be able to speak to 12 strangers and tell right. sometimes the most personal details of your life.
Throughout the case, this is kind of like an ongoing, I don't want to say argument, but discussion, me and Mandy kind of go back and forth with different opinions on. I feel you, because you kind of said that you feel Casey Anthony was super self-involved, and Mandy's kind of on your side as far as she's a self-involved person who didn't care about her child. I feel like Casey Anthony, given the inability she seemed to have to tell the truth at any point, that she had severe mental issues. I know it's super hard to do a defense of insanity, but do you think that there's any chance the defense could have used that with Casey Anthony?
I don't know enough about Florida's law. And when you say insanity, that's a little bit different. So, you know, typically the states will have not guilty by reason of insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And not guilty by reason of insanity means that the person, if found not guilty by reason of insanity, is now going to be under the care of the state. And so the legal standard that for that is pretty extreme. And I have never actually pled somebody not guilty by reason of insanity. In California, we have a different case, People v. James, that came out that allows for you to go unconsciousness, where you say my client, and it's pretty novel. You don't see this defense being run all the time, but that it used to be for things like sleepwalking. Let's say you were sleepwalking and you murdered someone. You can't be held legally accountable for that, because you weren't actively, consciously making those decisions. So we've been using it in San Francisco, discussing, it's really only been run at this point with schizophrenia, but the schizophrenia produces a similar result to unconsciousness. And that will give you a complete defense in the guilt phase. Meaning if you find somebody not guilty by reason of unconsciousness as a defense, they are just not guilty. So, no, looking at her, what I've seen from her interviews, what I've seen from her arrests, she does not seem insane, right? So you might be, if you're reading that she has some sort of disorder, now I'm no psychiatrist or psychologist, you know, just somebody who's worked with clients and has to kind of assess quickly and figure things out. It seems like she might have personality disorders, maybe borderline. I don't see evidence of that necessarily, but maybe borderline would fit. There's some evidence that she had a really bad temper. Then there was, I mean, some maybe some evidence of sociopathy. I don't know.
That's what I think. Like the sociopathy along with narcissistic personality.
Yeah, problem. I do think narcissistic personality and sociopathy can overlap, but not always, right? Because narcissists are very, and I think she probably would be closer to a narcissist or borderline, because it does seem she, you can lack empathy as a narcissist, and but still have emotion, right? It's like, I'm concerned about my own feelings, just not yours.
Right, right.
And, you know, sociopathy tends to be much more kind of cool, calculated. And so many of the decisions in this do not seem cool or calculated. They seem cold, like unconnected to the child, but they're not necessarily rationed, like reasoned. Like, I don't know. If she really did chloroform the kid, that does, that maybe leads to sociopathy in my decision, you know, my kind of framework. But you can have mental disorders and not be insane to the extent that you should be found not guilty by reason of insanity in California. You can have schizophrenia. For instance, you know, there's plenty of people who have, say, and where would we draw the line, right? It's like, say, ADHD who commit homicides, and we're not going to call them not guilty by reason of insanity. So it's a high standard. I don't know Florida's standard, but, you know, based on any state standard, I really think she wouldn't have qualified.
Well, I mean, if they did go for that kind of defense, wouldn't she have to admit to killing her daughter in order to be not guilty because of mental?
Mm-mm. No, people will often, because usually, at least in California, you'll do a two-part trial, two-phase trial, sort of like a death penalty. So you can do the guilt phase, and then you can do the insanity phase. Oh, we've got one going on in San Francisco right now where they're in the guilt phase.
You would think that if someone actually was, had some sort of mental disorder, there's a good chance too that they wouldn't even necessarily know they did it, right? So they might not even be able to admit it.
Sure, right. For instance, if we're talking about like unconsciousness, right? Like the defense that I used recently, that the hallmark of that is that you don't remember. Right. You're in such a psychotic state that if somebody asked you what was going on, you're like, I don't remember being there. Because you're experiencing such a psychotic episode to the point that your brain shut down, making those short-term memories. So they genuinely could pass a lie detector test that they were not present and did not have memories. So they may not be able to admit it.
Do they have to, in order to get that not guilty or the guilty verdict, they have to be fully aware that of right and wrong, right versus wrong, right? Otherwise, that's kind of where the mental decomp comes in.
No, I mean, I think the idea that I'm trying to think what you're trying to get at. There's a legal standard in that you have to be mentally competent to stand trial. But knowing the difference between right and wrong is a moralistic view that not everyone is going to share the same opinion. So you could never base it on that. For instance, if you ask me, is it wrong to steal makeup from Walgreens? I'm going to say, I don't really care. Right. So like the line's going to be real blurred for people when you're like, well, it's a big corporation who's stealing from their workers, like fair's fair, Robin Hood. Go, you know, loot them up. But, you know, so right and wrong, I think, is probably the wrong question. So you have to be able to kind of understand the legal proceedings that are being, and the charges that are being brought against you and what's happening. And can you interact and aid in your own defense? Those are sort of the questions that we want to ask. Like, do you know that this is the judge, or do you think that that's Big Bird and that none of this is meaningful, right?
So that's kind of where your unconscious defense comes in, because if technically they're sleepwalking, they're not physically conscious of their actions. Therefore, they can't be held accountable.
It's even more complicated than that. Like that client was actually, in my opinion, competent He could tell you I was his defense attorney. He could tell you that the judge was the judge. He could tell you the charges. He knew what was going on. But in the moment that this the stabbing occurred and when he hit the woman, he was in a state that I believed was severely psychotic. And psychotic states ebb and flow. But in that moment, if I had assessed his competency, I would have said he probably was not competent. But the moment that I worked with him for what, a year and a half, I found him to be competent. He knew my name. He remembered me. He always knew me. He always made, you know, kind of very reasonable decisions. You know, he never acted in a way that I didn't think that I could work with him. So he was always able to aid in his own defense and understood the charges and understood who the players were inside the courtroom. And that was sort of the level that I needed to say he was able to go forward. But so competency, unconsciousness, and the mental health defense at the guilt phase, and then insanity are all sort of three separate legal issues that can overlap. Like, you can have a client who's not guilty by reason of insanity, who also was unconscious, who's also potentially at times not competent to stand trial. If they're never competent to stand trial, they never go to trial, right? They go off. It's a different procedure. It won't waste time. But they all interplay, but they're all different standards. So to go back, I don't think she would have been any of them.
Okay.
That's fair.
She might have had disorders. She might have been in the DSM-5 all over the place, but I'm not finding her not competent. I'm not going with a mental health defense on this one, most likely, and I'm definitely not going reason of insanity. And the thing that people don't understand is, like, if you plead someone not guilty by reason of insanity, they're probably never seeing daylight again. So it's just as, you know, you might as well just plead them guilty and, you know, that sounds cavalier. I don't actually mean that. I think it's better for clients to go insanity in a life case or a death case. They sought death initially.
Yeah.
So there may be reasons, but they're not just, you know, going down to Starbucks the day after the trial.
Let's say that you were her attorney and the state, with the evidence that they had, I mean, there was a motive that they put forward of her boyfriend at the time stating that he never wanted to marry a person with a kid. You have the evidence that they came up with, which, I mean, granted, it's circumstantial because you can't pinpoint a cause of death, but I mean, the manner of death, it doesn't seem circumstantial to me, because, you know, given the fact that the body was found months later, obviously they can't run toxicology because it's no longer there. You know, there's no lungs, so they can't prove or disprove the, you know, Baez's theory of drowning and all that stuff. But the thing that really kind of bothered me with it is the duct tape that they found. And
something being circumstantial and something being direct and not liking it are kind of all different standards, right? So I agree with you. The body was found a long time after,
right?
So it feels like we want to call it circumstantial, but it's still very much direct evidence. And Yes, their hands were somewhat tied, right? There was a bunch of problems. One, found a long time afterwards, so you don't have the skin and the hair and those sorts of things to assess. So in terms of their pathologist or their medical examiner being able to do a good autopsy, they were going to have problems. Anytime there's decompensation, they're going to have problems. But that's part of why I think that the verdict was right, even though, if my own personal feeling is that she was guilty, right? Which is that, like, regardless of whether or not it's fair to, you know, justice or whatever kind of moral view you feel like, the body had decompensated and they were just left with bones. And then they had an outsider who came in and just messed everything up, right? So he came in and he poked the body with a stick or the skull, he moved things around. So things had been manipulated and DNA had been introduced to that scene. Things had been moved from the position that they had left. So now you're not even dealing with a you know, the body or the remains being in their initial position. So you can't assess how they were, like, dropped off or were there any other materials, like nothing. Now it becomes much more difficult to establish what condition the remains actually were in when they were left there. Were they thrown? you know, maybe someone could have determined those things. Maybe so there was more information that was missed because this outsider came in and kind of trampled on the crime scene. Now, I think he did so very kind of innocently, like it wasn't, he just saw a skull and wanted to figure out what the heck it was. But he did mess, he did introduce something that as the defense attorney, I could have jumped on. But without any of that, you know, I think it's tough, right? You can't look at the lungs. You can't look, and asphyxiation can be really tough to prove even when you have a body that's not decompensated. Asphyxiation is often very tough. So is drowning. You're not going to see some of the evidence. You know, maybe if it's strangulation that causes asphyxiation, you may see petechia or bruising or things like that. But just because somebody's airway, like say you smother someone with a pillow, and it's very peaceful, and they weren't struggling, and there was no signs of force, you might find fibers, you might find things like that, but you're very rarely going to find things in the like physiological, like remnants, right? Like in the trachea, the airway, in the lungs. So you'd be looking for introduction of outside elements. Mm-hmm. So if what would be good if they had the remains early on would be to look for chloroform in her system, to do a toxicology report, to do that kind of thing, to see what was in her system at the time. Had she been drugged? Was there presence of the chloroform? You know,
but they found that in the trunk though. Like they found evidence of chloroform in her trunk and.
Sure, but how does that link up to the body? So if you're looking at it from a purely legal factual standpoint, the fact that it was in the trunk, you now are making the assumption she was in the trunk. So they've proved it theoretically by showing there was a hair there, but you know, you've got to believe like my dog's hair is all over my car, like every last inch. So if you know, somebody like killed their dog, or not that I, God forbid, would do this to my 18-year-old love of my life, but you know, his hair is everywhere.
Right.
And so if you were to try to say, oh, well, his hair was in the trunk that proves she killed him. Well, no, his hair's on everything I touch. It, like it's on me, it sheds everywhere. So the hair there itself doesn't necessarily.
Well, now in regards to the hair though, from what I've read on the medical, Dr. Garavaggio's, I call her Dr. G, I can never pronounce her name. The hair supposedly was already in a state of decomposition and was removed from her head post-mortem. That's what I had read.
I don't know that. I haven't seen that. And I think that when it comes to, and this is one of the things that the defense attorney is very right about, is that they call it, he termed it, and I think it's actually very catchy, fantasy forensics. Hair, anything to do with hair is just guessing, right? Like they brought in an anthropologist to talk about a lot of these things. And there's no shame. I was an anthropologist who specialized in physical anthropology. But it's largely been debunked as a hard science, right? Maybe it can give you some information, but being able to say whether a hair came out post-mortem is really, really, really sketchy. Like that would be very difficult to say. I just think that they were trying to maybe grasp at straws there. And that's when that's because they didn't have the information. But to go back to the chloroform, presence of it in the trunk would be helpful if you could link it up to presence of it inside the body, right? So it's not a helpful fact. That, I mean, that's just one of those things that would have been really helpful if the ME medical examiner could have found the chloroform or say, you know, residue of the duct tape on her face or any presence of the duct tape fibers in her mouth or any, you know, bruising on her lips or on her face or, you know, irritation in the shape of the duct tape. Those would have been really helpful facts that I think could have then linked this up. And if I was the defense attorney, I would be saying, this is why we don't have reasonable doubt. This is what's missing. Right. And we don't have the body. And I know that's really difficult, but you would have to, with a jury like this, start them off by saying, we're not here to decide which story you like better. You're trying to decide whether or not the state has proven this beyond a reasonable doubt. And you can walk away from this feeling like she is guilty as sin, but if they haven't proven it beyond a reasonable doubt, and, you know, I would challenge you just as, you know, a podcaster, anyone where we're still super fascinated by the trial means that wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Because if it had been, why are we talking about it? Because one of the things I usually say in a lot of my trials is, if I came to you in a year, or right now even, I sometimes don't say right now because judges will give me crap. But what I'll say is, what if I showed you a video of what actually happened, right? The whole hour long thing between my client and his ex-wife and whatever happened, you'll get to see who went for the knife first. You'll get to see everything that happened. Do you want to see it? And if you say yes, they haven't proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. You need to be so sure that they've proven it to you that you would say, no, thank you. And part of why we know that the state didn't meet their burden is because we're all still talking about it, right? We're like, what really happened? What did they prove? Did they prove enough? And they didn't prove enough. And it's because we still have those questions, right?
You know, I don't like you because you're making me change my opinions now.
Yeah, she's got a lot of really good points.
Damn it! I really hate Casey Anthony. She definitely is a bad person.
But what you've done though is made me realize I know nothing about the law.
Yeah, me. Yeah, same.
Just the fact that Casey Anthony led the police on a wild goose chase by fabricating. I'll use that word here because she created stories that they proved were not true about where she worked and places that people that weren't even real that they needed to talk to. And to me, that's enough. But then after listening to you talk, I get that she can lie about everything under the sun, but if it can't be linked to evidence, it means nothing, right?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's just, sometimes it's up to the lawyers, you know? I mean, I think this is why people don't always love defense lawyers, or why some people are afraid of public defenders, because it's not all the same. And it's not all the same with prosecutors either. Like, some people are good at their job and some people aren't. And, you know, I had a mentor who once said, facts don't win and lose. No, the other way around. He said, lawyers don't win and lose cases, facts do. But I don't know if I believe that, right? I don't. I think
storytelling seems to win cases.
Huh?
Storytelling seems to win cases.
Sometimes, you know, and I think that, like, in a scenario like this, this one could have gone either way, maybe.
All right, so let's play devil's advocate here. Let's say that they had found her body and it still had the skin and everything on it, and they were able to tie the chloroform to the trunk to the body. Do you think the outcome would have been different just by that little piece? Yeah.
Sure. Yep. I think if they could have linked up some of the stuff to the body that showed because if I'm the defense theory, I'm saying, look, there's a circumstantial evidence rule. Mm-hmm. And it basically said, if there's two plausible theories, and this is California, but I assume Florida has, you know, a corresponding rule. But if there's two theories that you find reasonable, one can be more reasonable and the other one can be less reasonable. But if they're both reasonable, then you have to weigh in favor of not guilty. You don't get a choice. You don't get to decide which one you like better. And the problem is the prosecution put forward a really plausible, reasonable theory. They just didn't prove it. And the physical link is the body. Yeah. And I think that's really tough, you know, anytime. And they were going forward before they even had the body. And so, you know, this isn't all on the prosecution either. This is largely on their police staff. They should have been doing different investigations. They should have been, you know, simultaneously pursuing her theory about this Zendaya.
Yeah, Zenaida.
Zenaida. Right. Also, did she know that person? That's one question I want to know. How did this poor woman get looped into all of this?
This poor woman doesn't exist. She, well, the like, name made her up.
That woman. Well, they found a woman with that same name, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is horrible. Like, if she just pulled that name out of thin air and then they're like, we found one in Florida, not that far away. Like, that's crazy.
She pulled a lot of stuff out of there. Just.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you one more thing about the trunk. It was triggered. They had cadaver dogs and they were triggered at the trunk. What's the credibility of cadaver dogs? Are they not?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, I think it's probably the same credibility as a police officer, maybe. Right. Like, they're a living being who's trained to do a job, who makes mistakes. And you know, it's funny whenever you had like a dog in one of these cases, like a drug case or something, you get their background and who trained them and how long they've been working, you know, but these are animals who, you know, for whatever intelligence they have. And, you know, as a dog lover, I'll tell you, it's probably, you know, like a 7-year-old at this point, based on what we're seeing, how well they're learning to talk and like kind of think through cognitive issues, but they're fallible, you know, and it wants a treat and who knows what it smelled. And what is it looking specifically for human remains? I don't know enough about them, but they are definitely problematic, I think, for them. And yeah, I mean, that for me was probably the biggest fact. Because they did test that. Did they test something in the trunk? Did that come back to being her DNA on that spot in the trunk? It did?
I believe, yeah. Shoot, now I'm going to have to go back and check. I think so, yes. Or something, it came back as being decomposition of something.
Well, and I think he went with a theory that it had been the garbage.
The garbage, yeah.
So if he had done that, I suspect it didn't conclusively show that it was her DNA. It was her blood.
Yeah.
Or something, because if it had been that, that would seem to me to be much more solid evidence. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the dog alerted, if the dog alerted and there was her blood, I find that to be pretty persuasive. But otherwise, I think a good defense attorney can attack that dog. I mean.
Oh, they did. They did. They didn't really tell their Emmy about it.
Yeah. That just, it seemed fantasy forensics. I love that term. I might actually steal it. you know, like, how does this dog know? I mean, how does he know it's not just like a rotting T-bone versus a human?
Oh, man. Yeah. So would you have done anything different if you were on the prosecuting side?
I don't know.
Or could you have done anything different?
I don't know. I think they were largely there. I think they did a pretty decent job. Whereas, like, if you look at, like, the O.J. Simpson trial or even the Rittenhouse, which is a whole different story, those prosecutors, I think you can track kind of major mistakes that they made early on. I don't see that in this one. I don't see huge mistakes. I mean, I think, you know, hindsight's 20/20, and any lawyer can look back on any trial, win or lose, and say that their mistakes were made. You know, I can look at cases I won and say, like, ooh, I really messed that one up. But I don't see anything glaringly different. I think they played it right. I think they played it smart in the sense that they really kind of focused the narrative on her not wanting this. I think if I was them, there might have been more that they needed to do, because it's like the one thing I would have seized on as the defense is she had all these other options in terms of getting rid of the kid. Like, yeah. I would have asked her mom, if she didn't want the kid, would you have just taken her? Like,
you know what, Ben and I talked about that too, actually, yeah.
Well,
that would have been plausible.
You know, so I would have made a lot knowing that, like, Casey knew that her mom wanted that kid, like, wanted that kid so badly even. So why kill it? So the only other way it was maybe, like, is it like a Electra? Electra's wrong, because that's, like, the fight between the daughter and the father, right? Like, the weird tension between them. But is there something weird in the relationship between her and her mom that was so volatile that she didn't like her mom's attention on the kid? That it took away from her.
Maybe that's
the psychological element that they should have weaved in that they didn't, but how do you prove any of these things? So if their strongest piece was the emotional narrative, the psychological background as to what would motivate her to kill, you know, they can get in under motive, certain witnesses, they can get in character witnesses. They can talk about a lot of that, that maybe she's just somebody that likes to shirk responsibility no matter what. If this is something that she's done her whole life, that would be a hard, you can't bring that character in on its face. You can be like, hey judge, she's somebody who's irresponsible. There's only certain characters, violence, truthfulness, but you can frame a lot of character witnesses under her character for lack of truthfulness that would really kind of solve those kind of pieces that you would want, like that she just really didn't want responsibility, or that was really about this boyfriend, or what did the boyfriend say? I've got questions about what the boyfriend said, and was he kind of threatening to break up with her? Were there fights about her and the kid? So maybe they could have worked up the emotional narrative more. And if I was the prosecutor, I would have definitely done that, because you're not supposed to consider a lot of these things that are emotional. And those actually would have been factually probably reasonable things for a jury to consider under motive. But, you know, we shouldn't underestimate how much creating her as an unlikable, irresponsible, unconcerned, unloving kind of person would go. You know, like right. They kind of started, but I don't think they really sealed the deal on going all the way. So maybe that. But otherwise, I think they played it pretty smart. They didn't oversell their hand. They didn't over-dramatize things that didn't need to be. They were really not left with a lot of evidence. So as my defense attorney hat back on, I would say it was unethical in the first place to have so little evidence to charge her with first-degree murder. So little evidence that she did anything. Because if we really, all we have that links her to it, right? If we really just distill it down are her lies and the trunk. Am I missing anything?
There was some with the body, the teeth were intact. So they said it showed that the mandible was intact. So it showed that tape probably was there. But I think you're right that there was no tape residue. There's no tape. So that's probably negated at that point, right?
There wasn't any tape residue because her skin was gone. She didn't have skin anymore.
So just removing ourselves from the why didn't they have anything, which might not have been their fault. Just focusing on what did they have? What was the hard facts that they had at trial to show it was her, if you remove kind of all the speculation?
And it was the lies. I mean, they had... So the emotional aspect of it doesn't really play into it because, I mean, the 30 days that Kaylee was missing... We have video and picture evidence of her out partying, living it up, getting a tattoo, saying she has a beautiful life and all this other stuff. So that
right off the jump, she was in a hot body contest.
Yeah.
Like, so she definitely showed no concern for her child. So
is that not a type of evidence to show the kind of person that she...
Yeah, I guess we can put that in there, right? A lack of concern. If your kid really had died in a pool, are you really going to go to a hot body contest?
Right.
Or are you going to be too broken up? But, you know, if I'm the defense, my counterpoint to that is we don't convict people because they're crappy humans. Mm. We convict crappy humans who do illegal things.
Well, people better not put me on a jury.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people I don't keep, you know, just because it's tough. You know, we want to convict crappy people. But we can't. So if to go back again, like reasonable doubt is a really high standard for a reason, right? You've got clear and convincing evidence. So you've got preponderance of the evidence, which is for civil, right? Which is like more than likely. So think of it like fly on an elephant. You've got two elephants, one adds a fly. That's all you need for a civil case, which is why OJ was found guilty civilly.
Right.
It's just more likely than not. Clear and convincing is often used for like state taking away your children forever. Things like that. And that's higher than clear and convincing. That's higher than preponderance, but lower than reasonable doubt. So it's a really high standard for a reason. And so the idea is that all these guilty people are going to get away if the state can't prove it, and we just have to live with it. And otherwise, sorry, you know, we've got other states, I mean, other countries that employ different legal standards. But this is the one that we have, right? And it sucks sometimes.
Yeah. So basically my whole outlook on this entire case is I'm judging off of an emotional standpoint and not actual facts.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say you're trusting your gut and, you know, saying that you intuit that she did it based on all of these things doesn't mean you're wrong, right? It just... Let's remove it from you, but somebody assuming, and this is where cops and DAs and everybody gets it wrong. We think our gut, and our gut is often right. We think our gut is telling us she's guilty. And then we kind of don't do enough to support it because we're like, yeah, she's clearly guilty. Who just goes to a hot body contest? Like, we're so morally outraged by the actions that she took that don't amount to reasonable doubt in a courtroom that we kind of turn a blind eye to what may have needed to have been done in order to actually prove it up in a courtroom. So it's not like a moral failing on your part, right? That you're like, she's guilty and I hate her and I wish that this trial had gone differently, right? It's just, I think I feel that way about, I don't know if I want anyone to go to prison, but she's definitely a broken toy that I want off the island, you know, like she needs, I vote her off.
Yes.
So I'm with you that she did this, and that, you know, this, the verdict was right based on the evidence, but it doesn't sit well with me that there's a dead kid, and I think she did it.
Yeah. I think the thing we do need to do is we're guilty of judging the jury. Right. And they did the best they could with what they were given.
Well, I didn't know anybody was, but I think they did the right thing. And I'm not guilty of judging them. I think that they probably did something that's really hard, which is, and you know, anytime that you walk away thinking someone's guilty, but you came back not guilty, like there's a place, if there's a heaven, if you believe in that sort of thing, reserved for you. Because that means that you upheld the legal system at the cost of, you know, feeling good. Because it feels crappy, I think, sometimes. Like, and this is the one that I was telling about, the unconsciousness. I spent a lot of time telling them that they were going to feel this way, right? Like, you're going to feel terrible coming back not guilty. This is not the one where you're like, this was the wrong guy. The cops framed him. He's so innocent. Give him back his freedom. No, this is the one where he put a knife in someone's back. And you're going to still have to come back not guilty. And you're going to feel bad. But that's the legal system, you know? So I actually think, like, good job, jury. Like, that's a crappy thing to have to live with. Cause you're like, I want this person off the streets, but I swore under oath to uphold a legal standard. And if the legal standard isn't met, I have to do the thing that I swore to do, which is vote not guilty. And that is hard.
Girl, I gotta tell you, this conversation did not go anything like I had thought it was gonna go. Because for somebody to actually change my mind about something I am so adamant about, forgive my language, you're fucking good.
Yeah, no one can change Mandy's mind about anything.
So. Wow. I am like totally, my mind is blown.
Well, I'm passionate about being a defense lawyer, and hopefully I can change people's minds. So I try.
Oh God. Yeah. You're going to have to come on our show a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm happy to anytime. This was fun. Cause I really didn't know a lot about it. So, you know, I watched some, the true crime thing on IMDb or whatever it was. So it's fun to get to read about this, you know, cause it's those things you hear about, like going back and looking at OJ Simpson now that I'm an adult. Cause that was when I cried when that verdict came back. I cried.
You and Ben both. Yeah.
I know. And now
he was obsessed with it.
Yeah, for sure.
But now I'm like, that was the right verdict.
All right, girl, because we're gonna do OJ, so you're gonna come back for OJ.
Also, Rittenhouse. Oh, the Rittenhouse one is one I'm like walking around in a lot of pain about this one.
I don't know anything about it. I have tried to keep my head out of the stupid shit that's going on today because I just stay mad if I don't.
I know.
So, but that's I think that's one that we will probably eventually cover because it's. From what I understand, it's pretty juicy.
It's, well, especially if you like the legal stuff.
Yeah.
Right. I think there's so many things about the legal system that people don't know.
Yeah.
Influence. And that's a really good one, I think, to show people kind of all of this crazy stuff. Like, I think one of the ones you're struggling with in this time is the judges allowing them to open on facts that were never proven.
Right. Yeah.
But there's all these kind of weird quirks that you can get away with, quote unquote, as a defense attorney, or things that happen or don't happen. And so I am fascinated by the legal side. And
I think it's great to have you kind of coming on and doing stuff like this, because had you been a prosecutor, I think your views would have been different than what I'm seeing now. You're able to show a different side of things, whereas the prosecutors, I think, lean more towards, you know, cops and, you know, what they come up with and things of that nature.
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of times people hire ex-prosecutors when they become defense attorneys, and they're like, oh, they must be so good. No, they're the worst. Really, defense attorneys, if I could suck it up morally, we would be the best prosecutors, right? Because I was saying this about the Rittenhouse trial, but so often what you see with prosecutors is that they have people like you who are hell bent on their side from the beginning, because like, it's a moral thing, right? You can't really shake people from their morals. It's really hard.
Yeah.
And their feelings. So they often have morals and feelings on their side. So they don't end up having to be intellectually light on their feet. They don't end up having to take a lot of shade from judges or witnesses. So when faced with any adversity, they just crumble like little flowers. Like there's like, oh, someone yelled at me. And they're not very creative. And so they don't make great defense attorneys. But I do think a good defense attorney could be a good prosecutor, because I have to think through what the prosecutor is going to say and do. I have to know every one of their movements ahead of time if I'm going to act like counter it. But, you know, I also think prosecutors tend to have a very kind of strict worldview. Yeah. And that can be a hindrance, because you don't think that people, you don't necessarily think that through that people don't share that same worldview.
Sure. I can see that. But are any of your cases televised?
Yeah, well, right now, all of them kind of are, if you have the Zoom link. So it's been great. I actually really like it. My dad, who's 78 and he can't come to court, just sits there. My last trial is like 6 hours a day.
I would love to watch some of your trials, because you're just fascinating.
I have got another one. I've had 7 recently. Since COVID started, because they're just coming hard and fast, because there was no trials for a long time.
Yeah.
So I've got one starting on Monday, if you're interested.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's not that juicy, though. I mean, it probably sounds juicy to you. It's not that juicy to me. This is a bit of a break for me. It's not an attempt murder, just a simple domestic violence. So.
Hey, that's cool, because I'm passionate about that too. So.
But we start jury selection. And the thing is, I don't know if we'll televise motions, but for somebody who's as kind of intrigued by how the legal world influences verdicts and all of these cases, watching, I always tell new attorneys when I train them, trials are won and lost in motion work and jury selection. But after that, it doesn't matter, right? It's like you've already either, because motion work is where you're letting things in or keeping things out. Right. And so if a judge keeps out all of the prosecution's evidence and they have nothing left, you've already won. Or if you pick a really good jury and they already hate cops and it's a, you know, cop assault case, you've already won. So you're, if you think you're going to dazzle them with your closing, it's too late.
That's one thing I'd wanted to ask you. The motions that if it's relevant to the case, why would it not be allowed to be introduced into the trial?
So I actually had the opposite experience recently. There's so many different reasons why things may or may not be allowed in. So most states will have a balancing test between with what's reasonable and, you know, like what's relevant and what's too prejudicial, right? So if a fact is, you start by thinking, is this relevant? If it's not relevant, it's out, right? So let's say Casey had been molested by her next door neighbor at 16. That doesn't really seem relevant, right, to her allegedly murdering her kid, unless there was a really good way for someone to link that up. That would be deemed not relevant and too prejudicial in the sense that it might garner too much sympathy with the jury. But so that balancing test has to be done on each and every fact. Does the prejudice outweigh the relevance, probative value, right? So how helpful is it in this case? Then you have all sorts of other rules, which is there a foundation? Which is, let's say I wanted to offer a doctor to come in and say in, you know, the Casey Anthony case, to say that Kaylee had been burned alive. There's no evidence of that, right? So I would have to have a hearing to show that there was some evidence that would make my expert saying she was burned evidence of charring or something, right? You know, something to show it was relevant. Otherwise, there's no relevance. It doesn't even come in. It's just not relevant. And then there's things where, you know, things might be tainted, so it's not reliable. Then there's issues where it may not be, you know, it might be too time consuming, because that's another thing. It might be relevant. It might not be prejudicial, but it might be too unduly, you know, consuming of the court's time. So say like my last trial, I had character witnesses that said the complaining witness is a lying liar who lies. I had like 20 of them. He was like, pick two. And you're like, wait, what? And I'm like, but she says he stabbed her. I need a lot of people to say she's a big liar, because it's a big injury. So then it just gets kicked because of time consumption. Then there's things that it's like, if it depends who the witness is. So for like a client, if a defendant says, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, it didn't do it, and they say it 1,000 times, during, you know, confessions or interrogations, that's all excluded as self-serving hearsay. He has to take the stand. So I kept fighting to try to get all of my client's statements in where he had said he didn't do it 9 million times. But, you know, had he said he did it, that could have come in. So there's a lot of rules, but it's really the main takeaway, I think, for your purposes is there's a balancing test that happens on each and every fact, which is probative, relevant versus prejudicial. And so that's why a lot of times, so let's say there's an assault charge that's 30 years old in a domestic violence case, it may not come in. And then the jury finds out, well, oh, he beat up another woman 30 years ago. But the judge found it too prejudicial and not probative enough about what happened on this instance.
And now then, for something like that, is that based on the judge? Because I mean, sometimes they do allow past occurrences to come in and sometimes they don't.
Yeah, it's the amount of judicial influence in a trial is enormous. Enormous. I cannot, you know, overstate it, right? It's enormous. The amount of influence they have up until that point, not that much. Clients are like, ask him to dismiss this. And they're like, he can't do that. Not really. They don't have a lot of power, but once they get in trial, they have great power. And all they need to say is things like, oh, I've deemed this, like one judge might deem that 30-year-old conviction relevant and one might not. And then the appellate court largely will look at it and say, that's fine. You know, we have to allow judicial discretion because we can't start mandating hard, fast rules. And that's true. Even as a defense attorney, I'm not going to disagree with that. But what it means, though, is that person on the ground who might be very biased, who might be very prejudiced, who might be racist, he might be sexist, he might be classist, he then gets to have this enormous like bubble of safety on his decisions. And, you know, appellate courts are really kind of loath to overturn anything that was a decision of discretion.
Another thing that we were talking about before you jumped on is judges are not, there's no way that they can overturn a jury's conviction.
Wrong. So there's no way for them to overturn a jury's acquittal. Conviction.
So why is that? Is that just, is that like a constitutional
double jeopardy breaking? Because imagine if we could, the idea would be every prosecutor would challenge every not guilty ever. And how fair is that to put somebody through multiple times? And kind of, I bet, you know, when they're looking at this, and I don't know enough about constitutional law to say where double jeopardy came from, but I'm sure it dates back longer than there's been American law. I'm sure this dates back to, you know, English law. Mm-hmm. Cause I mean, would you frame that? Like how many tries do they get to find a guilty?
I didn't even think about double jeopardy. Would fall into it, wouldn't it? That's very interesting.
With a guilty verdict, Mandy was thinking that if the jury decides on a sentencing, that the judge could change that. Is that true?
No, yes and no. So it depends on the state. So let's say it was a guilty verdict and it came back for murder. I don't like that. Let's say it came back for voluntary manslaughter and some of the other lessers, assault, child abuse, causing great bodily injury. Now in California, you can throw out certain things. Right? There's now judicial discretion to throw out certain enhancements. So the great bodily injury, they can throw out to make somebody probation eligible on a voluntary manslaughter charge if they have no prior history. But they can't just throw out the voluntary manslaughter charge itself. They can only kind of do little tweaking in front of
them. So the judge, like for a first degree murder guilty conviction, if the jury sentenced them to life in prison without the possibility of parole, the judge couldn't come back and say, no, I want the death penalty.
Separate. Definitely can't do that. And let's break that up because I always say it's almost like a dinner party, right? The prosecutor chooses what to serve. The juror decides if it actually goes on the plate, right?
Okay.
And then I mean, like, you know, they can throw it out. But the judge is really the one who gets to decide how much.
Okay.
So there's a range. but they're not the ones necessarily. They can't say, oh, prosecutor, you charged the wrong charge, add something else. They can't say the jury convicted on this. I don't like it. I'm throwing it out. So they can't really control it there. All they can really do is say, okay, let's say you get convicted of robbery. I can give you in this range. If you get convicted of robbery causing great bodily injury, let's say you walk in with a knife and you cut someone, or let's use more extreme, the gun would be more complicated, but stick with that. Then they can throw out the knife allegation. They can throw out the cutting of the great bodily injury. They can pick 2 years because let's say they find factors in mitigation. Like this was a really young kid. He was only 18. He really needed money. It was a grocery store. So they could then find a way to get it from 2 instead of it being the max, which on a situation like that would have been 12. But to go back, they can't. Death penalty is a jury decision too. So there's 2 phases, kind of like the insanity. Both are for the jury. The jury gets to decide, are the charges proven? And then in death, it's a separate situation. They get to go life or death. It's called the death phase. That is a whole separate long debate in and of itself, because if you are somebody who's against the death penalty, you don't get to be on a death jury. So you never even get to hear the guilt phase. So obviously juries tend to lean heavily towards death because you're getting a death favoring panel to begin with. Like I would never make it onto a jury panel because I would say, I don't believe in the death penalty. And they'd be like, you as a matter of law cannot be on this. But that's the only time juries really get to decide sentencing. Otherwise, as a juror, when you're hearing this, even if it's a murder, you don't get to know or decide sentencing. You just say, charge proven or not proven. And then it's up to the judge. But then there's also different judges. So the trial court can't throw out the verdict, but the appellate court can, right? So there's another level. And then there's a Supreme Court level, depending on the state. And then you could also have it reviewed by the Supreme Court, depending on if you can get it there, of the United States. But so there's review levels where other judges look at what happened here. And then, I can't tell you how many times I've been in trial and I'm like, hey, judge, this is going to be overturned. Just so you know, you really screwed this one up. But then if you win, no one ever sees it. There is a process by which judges can get rid of charges if things got really bungled. But it has to be procedural, right? So a lot of times you'll see things being overturned because of, say, jury instructions. The judge didn't give the right self-defense instruction, didn't give the right experts, precluded witnesses from being able to testify. Mm-hmm. But they're not often going to go back and just be like, we don't think they got it right. They can do that. They can say, we looked at this entire transcript and there's not enough to support a guilty verdict, but that's very rare.
Okay. Wow.
So sorry, that was a very long legal lesson, but
I enjoyed it.
I think it helps informs. Judges kind of have their hands tied as to certain things, which is why I do think that it must be frustrating to sit through a lot of trials and be like, this is wrong, this is wrong. So you do start putting your finger on the scale of justice because you want it to go the way you want it to go. And it's got to be hard to watch 20, 30 years of maybe watching either people get convicted you didn't think should be, or the other way around, usually the other way around.
I couldn't do it. I'd end up throwing my gavel at somebody.
Yeah, you'd be the judge being like, oh no, we're not having any defense witnesses. You can't put on a defense. Screw you, Casey.
I totally would.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us would, especially after 20, 30 years, you'd be so frustrated of being like, these are rules I don't care anymore about. Let's just move back to a law of outlawry, like put her out there, say, like, take off the protection and let anybody go after who they want.
Oh my gosh.
I see how judges end up. It's like, in Maleficent, you're like, I see how you ended up this evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh gosh. Oh, Martina, thank you so much for coming on. This has been freaking amazing. I'm kind of mad at you, but that's okay. I'll move past it.
I'm here to debate anytime you want.
Oh girl, don't say that. You may regret saying that one.
Well, I had a lot of fun. And thanks for, this is a fun one. I had never really looked into this case. So thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you again. And you're definitely going to be hearing back from us, I can promise.
Awesome. For sure. Anytime I can make time, I'm happy to. And if you are interested in a link, I love when the public can come and see, like our goal is to pull back the curtain of the real trials, because the more it happens in secret, and that people don't know what's happening, you know, for better or for worse, I think people are very removed from the legal system and that it's harmful to the whole process. So,
girl, send me that link. Send me that link. I'll watch it on Monday.
Sounds good.
All right, Darlene. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
I am absolutely blown away by this defense attorney. She, like I said, I wasn't expecting her to come on and completely change my opinion of whether or not Casey should have been convicted. And she did. And I am still a little bit upset about that, but I'll get over it. It was a fantastic interview and I greatly appreciate her coming on.
Yeah, it was awesome. She has a ton of knowledge.
She does. She seems like she is very adept at her job. And I will be tuning in on Monday to watch her live in action on her court appearances. I'm actually kind of excited about that.
Yeah, I wish I could, but I will be working.
I'll fill you in and let you know how it goes.
Thank you.
Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff.